fuck about AIDS as there has been over the years.
Seems to have quieted down.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Seems like that triple cocktail thing has kicked in and kind of washed a lot of it away.
Yeah, well, we're going to make that the topic of the Saturday special for the next 2 hours. So let's start the show.
Let's do it.
Okay. Yeah.
Good morning. A brighter day is here. Good morning. May we bring you cheer.
We've got time. We've got tunes. We've got time, tunes, and temperature.
Get up and go. It's today, you know. On KSCO Radio.
Okay. Hey, back in the saddle after week absence. Went to the new media seminar in New York City, all about talk radio and the new media, and learned an awful lot, gang. Boy, big changes, I mean, are headed our way through the entire industry, and they're really exciting changes. Really exciting. Wow, I'm so excited, I can't even talk. Okay, here.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.
The world recently recognized the 25th anniversary of AIDS. Millions have died and many millions more will die of this devastating disease. What if everything you thought you knew about AIDS was wrong? Is the title of a book written by Christine Maggiore. She tested positive in 1992 and is now a public speaker and educator. More than 14 years after being told she had 5 years to live, she is in excellent health without using AIDS medications. Dr. Charles Geschechter has taught African history since 1968, is the author of AIDS, Underdevelopment and Sexual Stereotypes, Rethinking AIDS in Africa. His critical commentaries have appeared in many publications. Join us this Saturday on the Saturday Special with your host, MZ, and guests, Christine Maggiore and Dr. Geschechter, from 10 a.m. to noon, as we discuss a different side of AIDS. That's this Saturday on the Saturday Special from 10 a.m. to noon on your audio-inspired discussion station, AM 1080 KSCO.
Just dive right into it and welcome Christine Maggiore to the Saturday Special. Are you there, Christine?
I am.
Wow, you've got AIDS. Do you really have AIDS? Maybe it was a misdiagnosis. What do you think?
Well, testing positive is different from having AIDS in countries where you need to test positive in order to be diagnosed with AIDS. Most people don't know that in Africa and other parts of what we call the developing world, people are given an AIDS diagnosis with no test. In my case, I tested positive.
Wait a minute. Why would that happen? I mean, how can, without a test?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how, why? I mean.
Because the idea is that to save money and to work in situations where there's no access to laboratories and other means of medical care that one would receive here in the United States, they simplify things by diagnosing AIDS in people who have primarily four clinical symptoms: fever, weight loss, persistent cough, or diarrhea. And that's used throughout parts of most all of Africa. Any time you hear about AIDS cases, they're based on not having a test but having those clinical symptoms, or simply having computer models give estimates based on very small numbers of people actually being tested with tests that are not the kind of tests that we would be given here, because it would be considered medical malpractice.
Oh my gosh.
It goes many, many layers deep.
So
your question was, do I have AIDS? No, I don't. Unless you read some media reports in which I am said to have AIDS, but I do not. That's never happened to me. So.
Okay, and from what you just told me, there are an awful lot of other people in the world who supposedly have AIDS who don't.
Well, it's very difficult to distinguish what's going on in part of the world that very few of us visit or know a lot about, because it's precisely in these countries where people suffer from a variety of illnesses caused by poverty, malnutrition, lack of clean water, lack of access to basic medical care, civil wars, these same situations manifest in symptoms that for the last 20 years have been thrown into this AIDS pile. And rather than receiving relief for their hunger, for the fact that they have no clean drinking water, no sustainable agriculture, unemployment, civil unrest, we're sending condoms and highly toxic medication.
That's just scary. That's awful. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, okay? I mean, you were supposedly diagnosed with AIDS in 1992, I believe, right?
I tested HIV positive in 1992 as part of a routine medical exam. I had no symptoms or particular concerns.
Out of the blue, right?
Well, I was told it was the politically correct, socially responsible thing to do was take this test. I've been living out of the country for a number of years and really wasn't aware of the whole campaign around this idea that everyone should be tested. So I did it like I vote, I recycle. I just thought it was another good thing to do. And I was shocked and devastated when I was told that the results were positive and I could expect to die in 5 to 7 years.
Yeah. And so that stopped your life short, I'm sure.
It
right?
did, definitely. It sidelined it. I became a very active public speaker and educator for several prominent AIDS organizations and also was nominated to the board of an organization in formation then called Women at Risk.
Well, what were you speaking about then, and what had you done before this devastating diagnosis or misdiagnosis?
Well, during the same period in which I had tested positive, I was running a multi-million dollar clothing company that I'd accidentally started with some business partners. I'd been living in Italy, and I was also going to school to get my degree in business, to finish my degree in business, and that just came to a crashing halt because I believed that I was going to die shortly, and I thought it was my duty to preach the things that we hear about AIDS awareness to other people and hopefully save them. So I was very passionate.
Safe sex and no meat, no eating.
Yeah. These drugs are helpful. Safe sex. It could happen to anyone. All the things that you hear, I was a very passionate proponent of until I stopped at the urging of friends and examined some information that I had heard about but thought was absolutely ridiculous. And that's what my book is about.
And you stumbled upon that, too, as well? I mean, what was this information? Give us a clue.
Well, there's a whole body of scientific, medical, and epidemiological information that exists out there that the organizations I worked for and all the AIDS organizations, they don't present. They don't give that to you when you test positive.
And they know about it. They're just,
they dismiss it. Mm-hmm. They regard it as stupid, foolish, misguided. They say that the people who put this forth are anything from baby killers to Holocaust deniers and homophobes. And I was very suspicious about that very emotional reaction to what's supposed to be scientific information. So I looked into it anyway, and it was so practical, and it addressed so many of the anomalies I noticed. Even in my short time as being HIV positive, there were just things in my education and my own experience that didn't add up. And this information put it into a very clear perspective, and I thought it merited further discussion, and I was turned down on this idea of a debate and, just respectful, open, public dialogue on this topic to come to answers about what the heck was going on.
Certainly,
we have no solutions.
So you must have some thoughts about why you were turned down. I mean, what are they trying to protect that you were about to blow?
That it comes down to things that all of us human beings suffer from. We have a fear of change. We have a fear of loss of employment. we have a fear of espousing a cause with great passion and perhaps discovering that we've been working towards something that is not and maybe even the opposite of what we thought we were doing. When I discovered this information, I could no longer go out and preach AIDS awareness in the way I was taught because I felt it was causing more harm than good, and it was very misleading and not direct and honest.
So did you start preaching AIDS awareness in a different manner?
No, I just started examining this information and getting together with other people, and we would discuss it in groups. People noticed that things didn't add up in their own lives or in the medical literature. And eventually we founded what we thought would be an ad hoc organization where we would have a debate. We would invite a debate here in Los Angeles, a big city full of lots of AIDS organizations and doctors and activists. And it was remarkable in that it took about 5 years to get a debate on this topic going on, and it was a one-time-only event. And it was surprising what occurred.
Why did it take so long, and why was it one time only?
We were turned down by AIDS activists, AIDS organizations, AIDS doctors, because they said the information that we wished to bring forth and discuss was simply too dangerous, that people given an opportunity to examine this might interpret that. It's always assumed that people who are, quote, at risk are stupid and ignorant. And if anything was discussed that might put what we think we know about AIDS in a critical light, they would throw away their condoms and start having unbridled, unprotected sex and possibly all become HIV positive and therefore die of AIDS if we were simply to discuss the scientific and medical merits of what we call the HIV-AIDS hypothesis.
Okay, let's welcome our Dr. Schechter here, who's from the department, Professor Schechter from the Department of History at Cal State University Chico. Let's bring him on. Dr. Charles, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning,
Tom. Hey, welcome to the Saturday special. I believe you know Christine.
Yes, I do, and I admire and respect her work very much.
Tell us about your work.
Well, my work is as a field researcher in Africa, and I've traveled on 20 different occasions to Africa over the last 35 years or so. Most of my work has been on Somalia and Djibouti and Ethiopia, kind of rough neighborhoods in Northeast Africa. And it was in the late 80s, while working primarily in Somalia in semi-desert areas there, that I came to the startling conclusion that according to the World Health Organization's definition of an AIDS case in Africa, which, as Christine has pointed out, differs decisively from an AIDS case in the United States, I discovered to my shock and horror that actually I had all the four clinical symptoms that would warrant an AIDS diagnosis in Africa: fever, persistent cough, weight loss, diarrhea. And those were normal things that I acquired working in desert areas, subsisting off of a diet of smoked camel's milk and some bad meat and occasional vegetables in Somalia. And then I discovered if I got on an airplane and I went from Mogadishu to Nairobi, Nairobi to London, London, San Francisco, and back to Chico, the AIDS seemed to vanish. And so it led me to wonder exactly what was an AIDS case in Africa, and also, more importantly, how were these statistics, which dominate almost any report you'll read about AIDS in Africa, how were these statistics actually gathered? And the more I looked as a disinterested researcher, the more confused, mystified, and then angry I became. And so I'm currently at work on a book which I call The Plague That Isn't.
Wow. Gee. I'm sorry. Are you hearing a little interference from from other radio? Are you hearing anything but me?
I'm not hearing anything but you.
Okay, Jay, are you there? I'm hearing some interference here that I want to deal with here. If the audience is hearing it, if the audience isn't hearing it, then I can deal with it.
But I hear nothing.
Oh, okay. So over the air, it's fine. I guess I'm just hearing something else here. Okay. So we'll let Dr. Charles continue here. So what did you do? What did you do when you became angry?
I did what any scholar should do, and that is to try and provide a different context or a different set of explanations to perhaps delineate what it was that was making Africans sick, which is something I don't deny whatsoever. I think that the continent itself over the last 30 years has certainly degenerated in many ways by any kind of statistical measurement. The question was, is this social malaise, is this illness, is this this widespread array of sickness in Africa, is it caused by some mutant virus from the rainforest that jumped from a chimp to a human being to a truck driver to a prostitute, blah, 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 which is the standard explanation.
Right, and how could you ever find that out anyhow?
sort of exactly like Christine pointed out, by going back and reading the establishment literature itself, and as a scholar, as a critically trained historian, what I did was to do what we all do as historians. First of all, look at the facts, examine the theory, and then wonder if there wasn't a different theory about those facts that might be more plausible and less prone to error. And it is the literature itself, as Christine made crystal clear, it's the literature itself on the side of the AIDS orthodoxy, which cannot stand close scrutiny by a detached outsider. So the way that she went about questioning her so-called HIV diagnosis is exactly the same sort of trail that I followed as an economic historian of Africa, concerned about record-keeping, statistics, illness, malnutrition, tuberculosis, malaria in Africa. I went to the established sources, and there is where you will find, as she pointed out, this amazing array of flaws, inconsistencies, inaccuracies, failed predictions, and so forth. None of which, by the way, is dare to be remembered or recalled by the members of the AIDS Orthodoxy.
Yeah, because they seem like fools, but why would they want to perpetuate a hoax or untruths? That doesn't make sense either.
I'm not a psychologist or a tarot card reader, and I can't really get into their heads very well, but I would just offer as a brief answer to your good question that the number of people who have staked their professional careers and their public standing on the theory that HIV causes AIDS and that's a death sentence and toxic drugs and condoms and just saying no to sex will keep you alive, those people, Michael, cannot come onto your program and say to an audience, you know, we got it all wrong. They can only come onto your program and say, you know, it's far more complicated than we thought.
Yeah.
That's their protective shell, basically.
You know,
Christine and myself try to penetrate that shell, where we are, as you might imagine, extremely unwelcome visitors.
I was going to say, I know you've been on some bigger shows, right, obviously, than the Saturday Special, right? So you're not completely shunned, at least by the media. Am I right?
I've been on, Good Morning South Africa, for example. I've been on Good Morning America's version in South Africa. That was about 6 years ago. And, was asked the normal array of questions for which I had to give 35 and 45 second answers. And I can tell you, upon leaving the studios there in Durban, where the AIDS conference was held in 2000, the African cameramen and the other African technicians, once they heard where I had been in the field in South Africa, embraced me, and they said, you really do have this clear. You really do understand what's going on in the field, in the bush of rural South Africa, and it's not about sex. It's about poverty. It's about despair. It's about ignorance, and it's all about the peculiar history of apartheid and racial divide in that country. It's no more complicated than that. It's the theory of Occam's razor, the old theory that the best explanation is the simplest one, not the most complicated one. Einstein said things should be made as simple as possible and not one bit simpler.
Right. Well, okay, so we were joking a little earlier. I've never met you, and the first time I spoke to you was about 15 minutes before the radio program today when I called just to confirm that you would be there and so forth. And we were joking. I mean, you were joking about you screen your calls because it might be Good Morning America or Oprah and so forth. And I believed that you've been on those programs, but apparently you haven't.
I'm afraid, Michael, I was just teasing you.
I know. Clearly, that I'm figuring that out now. And so you can't get to – they won't give you the time of day, the mainstream media, apparently. Is that right?
Not really, no. I mean, occasionally I've had articles published in newspapers around the country.
And so you're dismissed as a nut or something, or what?
No, I am as unwelcome. I am as unwelcome in the world of AIDS orthodoxy as the devil would be at a Christmas mass demanding proof of Jesus' existence. That's how welcome I am.
That's worse than being dismissed as a nut. I don't. We're We're talking with Dr. Charles Geschechter from the Department of History of Cal State Chico. He's quite an expert on how should we say this, the possible misinformation of AIDS, dissemination of information of AIDS information all for the last 30 plus years. I mean, the whole thing is not as it seems here, and according to Dr. Charles here, and we also have our guest on the other line, Christine Maggiore, a founder director of Alive and Well AIDS Alternatives, and author of the book What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong. Professor Charles, I believe you've written a book as well, right?
I'm working on a book, and delivered conference papers, but I'm working on a book that is tentatively called The Plague That Isn't, which is all about the history of the creation of knowledge about so-called AIDS in Africa over the last 30 years.
Right. Okay, Jay, did you say something?
We need to take a break, and actually I am hearing the interference now.
Yeah,
so I'm trying to
okay, so maybe...
I think it's line 12.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on here. So, Charles, if can, I hate to ask, would you mind calling that emergency number that we talked about earlier? Do you have that handy? We can't call out on that for some reason, and is that okay?
Yeah, you want me to hang up and call that number?
Yes, if you would, please.
I will do that.
Okay, hey, thank you very much. And we'll bring, I guess we'll take that commercial break right now. You're listening to the Saturday Special on your favorite radio station, complete with the finest technical difficulties of any station on Earth, AM 1080 KSCO. Michael Z with guests Christine Maggiore and Dr. Charles Geschechter talking about AIDS. We will be right back after this commercial break. Stay with us.
Tired of monkeying around with broken sprinkler heads and smelly lawnmowers? Weeds and dry patches make you scream. Growling over your decision to put a plant the size of an elephant in the space the size of an African hedgehog? Navigating your way through the maze of gardening and landscaping options and maintenance for your home or office really is enough to drive anybody wild.
Hi, I'm Randy Quilici, owner of Quilici Gardening and Landscaping. If anyone knows there's a jungle out there, it's us. We've been offering complete maintenance and landscape installation for residential and commercial properties since 1982. It's easy to let things get overgrown and out of hand and keep putting off adding that special water feature you've wanted for so long. Let us help by taming and shaping your landscape into something you'll be proud of. Call me at 425-5269 or visit us at QuiliciGardening.com.
Quilici Gardening and Landscaping, because without them, it really is a jungle out there.
It takes a lot of energy to sell your home, and I've energy to spare. Hello, I'm Heidi Theodore with Sherman & Boone Real Estate, and I do have energy to spare. Listen.
Hi, fellow KSEO listeners. This is Mark Fogel. Last year, when I wanted to sell my house, I watched a six-month contract with one agent expire and a three-month contract with another agent expire, and still I had no sale, and I didn't know what my next move should be. Then, I heard Heidi Theodore's amazing ad on KSEO, and I figured, how could I not call her? After all, she had the energy to sell my home, and sell it she did, even before we did the improvements that she has suggested. So if you're thinking about selling your home, I highly suggest you call Heidi Theodore. She is a ball of positive energy. She'll get the job done, and you will enjoy meeting her, I promise.
When it's time to sell your home, list with someone with energy to spare. That's me, Heidi Theodore, at 831-818-1256. That's 818-1256. Or HeidiTheodore.com. Oh, by the way, there's only one Heidi Theodore, and that's me.
Hi, I'm Dr. Guy Peabody. If fear is preventing you from seeing the dentist, listen to how we've helped others with sedation dentistry.
Hello, I'm Pat. I've had probably 40 years of dental drama and trauma, and usually I would go in for a dental procedure only when it was an emergency. Probably had about a dozen different dentists. None of them were painless. I would quit. I wouldn't follow up my procedures, and it would lead from one disaster to another. I would highly recommend Dr. Peabody to anybody that has any tension or apprehension about a dentist. He's the man, and I'm a true believer.
We've helped hundreds of people wake up to a beautiful smile. Let us help you, too.
Call Dr. Guy Peabody at 457-0343. That's 831-457-0343. Find Dr. Peabody's sedation dentistry on the web at drpeabody.com or in the Yellow Pages. You too can wake up to a beautiful smile.
Hello, I'm Robert Stangero. Many Santa Cruzans know me as Big Boy. The original Stangero family has been in business since 1879. Our name stands for quality, quantity, and great service. Our Gilda's restaurant on the Santa Cruz Municipal Wharf is still the fishing headquarters for the area. It's where fishermen gather every morning for coffee and breakfast before heading out on the bay. Stop by Gilda's and say hello. Both Gilda and I and my son Dino look forward to meeting you at Gilda's at the center of the Santa Cruz Municipal Wharf.
I have a job to be done. It may not seem like a big job to some, but I built this business from the ground up. It's a big deal to me. That's why I went with Granite Construction for my parking lot, retaining walls, and site development. They delivered value and got the work done on time and on budget. That's covering my bottom line.
We have a job to be done. This is our home, and we wanted quality workmanship. We're talking curb appeal. It has to be beautiful. Professional and friendly expertise was what we got from Granite Construction. They've got the people and resources, and they got our job done right away.
This big project at work is important and a big reflection on me. I can't lay awake at night wondering how this job will go, so I called Granite Construction. Granite's people are backed by a culture of workmanship, safety, and quality that I just trust. And they have their own local sources for materials. Take no chances. Go with the best. That's my motto. That's project peace of mind. Call 1-800-GRANITE. What can Granite build for you?
Hi, this is Nancy Norris with Norris Financial Senior Benefits and Services. I'm here today to introduce you to a new program that we're going to be hosting here on KSCO starting next Monday from 1 to 2. Our show is going to be called Boomer Talk, the program that will be addressing financial issues and elder care issues, estate planning, and anything relative to boomers. The program will have something in it for you. It's call-in talk shows. So remember, our Boomer Talk radio show is every Monday from 1 to 2 on KSCO.
If you think you missed the boat on low mortgage rates, think again. This is Jim Chubb with Pacific Inland with more good news for homeowners and home buyers. There are still mortgage loan programs that offer low rates and lower payments than you can possibly imagine. If your goal is to save money on mortgage payments, pull cash out for any reason, or to pay your home off early, please call Pacific Inland today at 475-2600. That's Pacific Inland at 475-2600, licensed by the California Department of Real Estate.
Mark?
Yes.
Dennis here from Day and Night Computer.
Hey, what's up, Dennis?
Checking in on you, man. I haven't heard from you. Most of the time people get a new computer, they call me with a question or two.
I don't really have any questions yet.
But you're pretty happy with it, though, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I'm very, very happy with it, Dennis. It's very impressive. Thank you so very much. It's a godsend. It really is. Better than anything you could buy at the store, that's for sure. So everything's working good on it so far. Yeah, I'm just very grateful to you for selling me such a good computer. Maybe that's why I haven't called you, because it was working so good. It's so darn fast. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, is that what you like the most?
Yeah, the speed and the features that it has. You know, it's just a very nice computer.
Talk to Day and Night Computers. Call 465-7340. That's 465-7340. Do yourself a favor.
Music, wonderful music on KSCO.
Definitely one of my favorite old KSCO jingles. Welcome back. We're in hour number one of the KSCO Saturday Special discussing AIDS with Dr. Charles Geschechter and Christine Maggiore. Let's bring them both back on now. I think we've shaken the technical difficulties, I believe. Are you there, Dr. Charles?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Thanks for calling back. We appreciate that. Now, you've got a background in media, I think, don't you? Weren't you with KRON-TV at one time, or PBS, or all of the above? Is that what I say?
Well, you're very kind to say that, but actually back in the 80s, I actually made a movie. I produced and directed a documentary film for WQED, Metropolitan Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, uh-huh. Public Broadcasting, on Somalia.
The Parching Winds of Somalia?
Parching Winds of Somalia was shown to a couple of million people nationwide. That was my only stint as a filmmaker. But in the early 90s, when there was the UN and U.S. intervention in Somalia, I was one of the few people that knew quite a bit about Somali life and Somali history and politics. So I was constantly on the media, commenting on CBS National Radio Network and KRON in the Bay Area on what was happening with this Operation Restore Hope in Somalia at the time. So that was my little brush with the media before discussing the whole AIDS, the old AIDS business.
Right. And how is it that you came to meet Christine, whom we will have on right now? Are you there, Christine?
I am.
Okay, good. We'll lock you both in, and that way we can all talk together. So how did you guys meet?
Boy, I don't. Let me think.
Because you've been on other broadcasts together, I think, right?
We have been on broadcasts together. I have been down to Los Angeles on a couple of occasions and have talked to Christine's group at their monthly meetings. And Christine and I shared a forum together at least twice in San Francisco when ACT UP San Francisco, in fact, had us for one of their meetings. And I think that's probably where we first met, was at one of these...
What's ACT UP?
Encounters.
What is ACT UP?
Christine, you recall what ACT UP stands for?
AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And it normally is an organization that... Well, it began with the activists who were demanding... Their tagline was drugs into bodies. Faster approval of AIDS drugs, get them into bodies as quickly as possible. And from the very inception of their activities, they began taking pharmaceutical company contributions. And in my opinion, this is certainly, well, it certainly seems to influence their viewpoint, because they are adamantly opposed to the idea of natural health, even angry over discussion of vitamins and things like that. But this one branch in San Francisco, ACT UP San Francisco, took a more open-minded approach to the AIDS issue and invited speakers such as myself, Dr. DeSchechter, Peter Duisberg, and others who are more critical thinkers about the HIV-AIDS paradigm and the idea that drugs into bodies are the only solution.
Fascinating. That's one of my favorite topics, actually. In fact, we've done a number of Saturday specials on the power of the pharmaceuticals, and how it's my belief that that the federal the Drug Administration is really the pharmaceutical industry and not the government. Anyhow, that's I guess that's a different. Would you agree with that? I mean, I had no idea this topic was going to come up in this program, but I'm happy that it has, actually.
I think that there is a lot of unhealthy influence in that area. It's clear, but you know, the drugs that are being pulled off the market after someone finally acknowledges that they're hurting people. What most of the public doesn't realize is that these so-called life-saving AIDS drugs have some of the most severe warnings attached to their literature, that they've only been tested for very brief periods of time. And most people have no idea that there have never been studies conducted in which they compare these AIDS drugs in a group of people who are positive and taking them to a group of people who are positive and not taking them, which is the way that you used to have to test a drug to see if it works when compared to
nothing.
Wait
a minute. Were those ways suspended for AIDS drugs, or is that the way it is for everything now?
AIDS drugs have diluted and corrupted the drug approval system. It's had a tremendous impact. These drugs into bodies chant reverberated, I think, throughout the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry is a really great idea. If you can get things fast-tracked, you don't have to prove they work. And since about 1987, it's been considered officially unethical to test an AIDS drug in a normal, ethical manner.
So AIDS drugs have been put in a special category by themselves. You keep hearing that it costs hundreds of millions of dollars. I think someone said $800 million, and I don't know if that's an inflated figure or not.
That's about right.
$800 million to get a drug approved as a drug, right, so that you can sell it via prescription.
And you need to.
And now, is that not the case? That
costs,
is that not the case with AIDS drugs now? I mean, if it costs $800 for a non-AIDS drug, does $800 million? Does it cost $100 million for AIDS drugs?
The first AIDS drug was a recycled cancer drug that had never been approved for use in cancer chemotherapy. So there wasn't a lot of research and development costs invested in that, and it's been a pretty big profit maker because of that. Also, the trials were briefed and were aborted before it was shown in, to any degree of proper standards that this drug was able to help people and to do so without hurting them. Anytime you cut down on the trial process, the need to carry it out for a number of years, the drug companies save countless millions of dollars. So this has been a great boon to them.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I can imagine. And I'm just fascinated by and actually angered by the fact that on network television now, over 50% of the commercial announcements that you see are for prescription drugs. You know, and they have the little disclaimers at the end saying, you know, this they have this side effect and that side effect, many of which add up to being more severe than the original malady.
Well, there's an official name for that that's been brought up in recent media, especially outside the United States. It's called disease mongering. And various public interest groups and even some medical publications are questioning this notion of creating syndromes out of common human behaviors and challenges. There's something called SAD, social anxiety disorder. It's when you feel shy around groups of people you don't know, have a hard time speaking up at parties or public events, and they want to medicate that along with so many things. And well, this is officially called disease mongering.
I'm going to remember that. That's, and I'm going to start using that term, actually, that phrase. I'm going to give out the phone numbers if anybody wants to call and chip into the conversation here. You're listening to the Saturday Special on AM 1080 KSCO. Michael Z with Dr. Charles Geschechter on the line, and also Christine Maggiore. And we're talking about AIDS, and we do have a first caller on the line, and Stan, and if this is the Stan I think it is, I'm sure he will bring quite a interesting perspective to this program. So let's bring on Stan now. And are you there, Stan?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
First of all, I would disagree with Dr. Geschechter. Of course, he's talking about AIDS in Africa. He's not talking about the AIDS epidemic in first world countries. And of course, your other guest is talking about the dangers of the drugs that are used and how toxic they are. And I agree that there is a great deal of confusion about the World Health Organization definition of what AIDS is in Africa. And there is much to be concerned with the drugs we're using here in America. But we should crystallize the issue. Is there an AIDS epidemic in the world today? Or is there a conscious effort to confuse the people and to be debating the wrong issues? And as you know, Michael, I spent a decade working as a physician within the California Medical Association to try to get an effective public health policy to stop this terrible epidemic in America. Today it's killed 500,000 people in America. Another million are infected, and we're arguing over whether there's an AIDS epidemic in Africa. Yes, there's much to be said against the World Health Organization's definition of AIDS, which was specifically laid out to confuse people. Just as here in America, we could have stopped this epidemic back in 1986 or 1987 if we'd done the logical things, tried to identify the people who really had the disease, make sure that they had, if they had a positive HIV, that it was accurate. And then, of course, kept them from spreading the disease to other people. We did not do it. We have 500,000 people dead in America. We have another million people who are infected. And there is this organized effort to confuse the people as to whether or not...
I think both of our guests would agree with that, Dr. Stan. By the way, for the benefit of our guests and the listeners, this is Dr. Stanley Monteith, who certainly has a great background in AIDS himself. You want to give us a little? Well, you've already given us a little bit of a background, but we're all on together. Christine, do you have something to say to Dr. Stan?
Yeah, I understand his passion about this issue. Certainly, none of us want to see human suffering on any scale, on any level, in any part of the world. And he's right. You know, there's differences between what AIDS is in the developing areas of the world and the first world. But a lot of this boils down to some things, and he talks about this confusion. There is a lot of confusion, and when he talks about are people really infected, it really everything kind of comes down, at least in the United States, where we rely on these tests to say if someone is infected, to a few simple facts that are rarely discussed. I'm sitting here with the accompanying literature from several major HIV tests, and they all make very interesting statements about how they cannot tell, first of all, the difference between cross-reactions and true positive reactions, and how there is, quote, no standard, no recognized standard for establishing the presence and absence of HIV antibody in human blood. They all disclaim themselves from the use of saying who is actually infected, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved none of these tests, not one, for the specific intended purpose of diagnosing HIV infection. So we have a problem here that leads to a lot of confusion. Why are we calling people HIV infected when, in fact, the tests themselves, this literature, is put together by the drug companies in conjunction with their attorneys to lay it out as it is? They say that these tests cannot be used to detect the virus itself or any specific markers.
Well, I'm sure that you're well aware of the fact that after you have the HIV test...
Wait. Christine, I'm not sure you can hear Dr. Stan.
Oh, no, I can't.
Okay, speak up louder, Dr. Stan. Too many of us are on conference here.
All right.
If you speak really loud, hold on. Just you hold down, Christine, for just a second. Sure. See if you can hear Dr. Stan. Go ahead. Dr. Stan, go ahead.
Well, I'm sure Christine knows full well, as she says this, that after you do an HIV test, you do a confirmatory test. And then you do another confirmatory test, and there are other confirmatory tests. So you talk about one thing, you talk about the unreliability of the HIV test, which I agree with you, it's not 100% accurate, but you ignore the other tests that are done to confirm this. And so what we do is we begin arguing whether the epidemic is there, whether we should be doing testing for it, whether we should be trying to stop its spread, and we're arguing the wrong issue. The issue is, why haven't we tried to stop this epidemic? Why have we let 500,000 people die in America and another million become infected in America? Why are we allowing this disease to spread in Africa? If you go into Botswana, 46% of the pregnant women, they're HIV infected, and they're almost all going to die because we're arguing the wrong issues. There is an organized effort of disinformation out there, and Michael, I hope you'll have the courage to invite me down sometime, and I would be glad to spend 2 hours talking to you about population control. We are really killing off Africa, and we're killing off the blacks here in America, because this is primarily a black disease. In the United States, it's not a white disease.
Michael, can I comment?
Please, Dr. Charles. Yeah, you know.
Listen, I could not disagree more with what your Dr. Stan is saying. First of all, let's be crystal clear about something. If he wants to claim that there is some kind of a demographic effect that AIDS, and I'll get back to the definition in a second, is having on Africa, he's going to be hard-pressed to explain how the population of Africa has grown by over 250 million since the onset of the so-called, age of AIDS. He asked, is anyone denying that there's an AIDS epidemic? He wants to frame the question that way. My answer is, let us be clear on what AIDS means in Africa. And if he is asking, is there an epidemic of high fever, persistent cough, weight loss, and diarrhea, I'm going to tell him, absolutely, there is just such an epidemic. But it is an epidemic of the old common maladies that have afflicted the most underdeveloped continent in the world throughout the bulk of the past century. And what's killing Africans...
I hate to do this. I know you're on a roll. But someone, either Dr. Stan or Christine's nose, is breathing on the telephone handset. And it's very irritating. So be conscious of that, please. Okay. All right, go ahead.
What I'm suggesting as an economic historian of Africa is that I'm not interested in discussing the molecular biology of HIV. I'm not interested in discussing, for example, what a viral load means. I'm interested in talking about AIDS. AIDS cases in Africa, because when somebody like Dr. Stan talks about the size of an AIDS epidemic, he's talking about something mathematical, he's talking about something statistical, and I'm here to tell him that those numbers on the African continent are the poorest, most limited in terms of derivation of any vital statistics. That's not my claim. That's the global burden of disease study from Harvard. So it makes perfectly good sense to me to understand why
rather than talking about the social conditions that produce malaria, tuberculosis, protein anemia, respiratory illnesses, instead, Africa has been brought in by the AIDS establishment to explain something that has not occurred and never will occur in this country, and that is there never has been and there never will be an epidemic of heterosexual AIDS cases in Western Europe or in San Francisco or in California or the United States. And there's no way to explain that if, in fact, you believe that AIDS is caused by some kind of a virus that spreads sexually. Hence, the emphasis on Africa, which is what I would like to talk about. When somebody says, well, what about Africa? I'm the guy to answer that question. Anytime Dr. Stan would like to go toe-to-toe on that point with me.
Well, I would Why don't you start now?
I would love to, but right now I think the important thing, I would agree with you, the WHO definition of AIDS was specifically put out to confuse people and to give a justification for this planned confusion as to whether or not there is any AIDS epidemic in Africa. I've talked to many of the doctors from Kenya and from Tanzania, and they will tell me that so many people are dying of what they consider to be AIDS, not this crazy World Health Organization confusing definition, but people that have an entirely different disease with a low CD4 count and an attack on their immune system. I believe there's a planned effort to confuse us about the issue. And why would the World Health Organization put out such a stupid definition unless they were trying to confuse people? I would
No, actually, that's not the answer. The answer can be found in some of the people who were actually at the famous Bangui conference in October of 1985 in the capital of the Central African Republic that was sponsored by France and by the World Health Organization. And it's Joseph McCormick and his physician wife in their book called The Virus Four Hunters who make it crystal clear that there was a bandwagon, they admit that, I don't have the quote in front of me, in that book, there was a bandwagon effect that was taking hold by 1985, and a lot of people in Africa and other public health people wanted to get aboard that bandwagon. And so they came to a very hastily concluded definition of AIDS in Africa, so as they say, along with Kevin DeCock from the CDC, that they knew what they were counting. That is the history that needs to be gone back, looked at, unraveled, and demystified. And then if you do that, Dr. Stan, you will see that the so-called epidemic of some sexually transmitted virus vanishes. Now, if I were Dr. Joseph McCormick or Kevin DeCock, I would not want to have that revisited under any circumstances. And I wouldn't blame them for concurring with what you just said about planned confusion. I don't give them that much credit. I don't think there was planned confusion. I think it was laziness and a kind of bandwagon mentality that took over at the time.
Well, I would point out that if you go into a country like Zambia or some of the other countries where a disease has had such a profound impact, or Rhodesia, you know, where they previously had an average age for a male of 60, now it's down to about 36 years, you point out that the population of Africa has grown by a couple of million. It would have grown probably by 100 million more or 50 million more if it had not been for this disastrous epidemic that is there. And there is an HIV epidemic. There is, and it's not just HIV. It's a combined infection. And if we had time, we could go into the part that mycoplasma plays in this, which nobody ever wants to talk about. But, you know, there is a population control agenda, which is the major thrust of American foreign policy. It was put forward in 1974 over the signature of Henry Kissinger. It's called the National Security Study Memorandum 200. National Security Study Memorandum 200. And they want to reduce the population throughout the world, specifically in Africa. They're doing a great job of it. And I'm sure you're very well motivated. But there is an AIDS epidemic in Africa, as there is an AIDS epidemic throughout the rest of the world. And there is an organized effort to get us arguing on the wrong issues. Is there an AIDS epidemic? Yes. Are people dying of it? Yes. And we could spend a great deal more time as to why we are not doing what is logical in the United States. Why are we not doing what's logical in Africa to stop this epidemic? And that would be something that would take us several hours to develop.
Well, I couldn't. Listen, you do not have any statistical backing for what you said about, rates of AIDS among blacks in America, for example. This notion that there's some kind of a plan to reduce the population of blacks doesn't square with the document I've got in front of me, which is the CDC's death spinal data for 2003, which came out April of this year, which makes it crystal clear that the differences in life expectancy between whites and blacks continues to narrow every single year. Now, if there's some kind of a mysterious and fabricated plan to reduce the black population of the United States, which is belied by all the statistics you can ever amass on this issue, which is, I think, crucial, how do you explain how the black population continues to gain ground when the white population in every kind of mortality pattern, any kind of statistical measurement over the last 30 years? Explain that to me.
Well, we're talking about AIDS, aren't we? Aren't we talking about AIDS? And we're talking about AIDS in the United States, and 60 to 65% of the new AIDS cases in the United States are in black population. Can you explain that to me?
Which, of course I can, because...
Why is 60 to 65% of the new AIDS cases in the United States in the black population, and why is the incidence of the disease so much higher in the blacks than in the whites, in Africa and in the United States?
Because AIDS is a disease of poverty and lack of medical attention. Yes, there are racial disparities between whites and blacks in this country. What you have to answer is what has happened. Don't give me rates, Dr. Stan. Tell me numbers. Shall I give you the numbers, for example, of actual AIDS cases among blacks in San Francisco versus whites over the last, whatever you would like to say, 10 years? How is it possible that the number of black cases of AIDS has almost vanished in San Francisco? How is that possible?
Well, I'm talking about throughout the country. Why do you want to go to San Francisco? Why don't you look at
because
the
CDC? Because unlike you, I've got
wait a minute.
Right in
please,
front of me.
Please don't
why.
Interrupt me. I gave you the chance. I was not rude and interrupted you. I have the CDC statistics, and I will be glad to provide them for any of your listeners out there if they want to contact me, showing that the predominance of new AIDS cases in the United States and new HIV infections is in our black population. And the reason for this is because there are certain racial differences, genetic differences between black and white. And anybody could read my article. It was in the one of the major medical journals, and I'll be glad to send a copy of that to any of our listeners, where we point out, quoting the scientific differences, that it has been definitely shown that blacks are much more prone to get this disease than whites.
It's just not borne out by the data right in front of me from the San Francisco Public Health Department.
Well, wait a minute, you're talking about
San Francisco. Hear me out now. 99 cases of AIDS among blacks in 2001, 72 cases of AIDS among blacks in 2004, 60 cases of AIDS among blacks in 2005, and through the first quarter of 2006, one.
I would simply point out that I have the CDC statistics that point out that in the United States, 60 to 65% of the new AIDS cases are in blacks. One of us is lying.
You won't give me a number. I'm not interested in rates. Give me the absolute number, not the rate. How many new AIDS cases among blacks are we talking about in 2005? That's the number I want to hear from you.
Well, if you'd like, I will go get those figures for you.
I've got to hold on the line here,
Michael. Yeah, we'll put you on hold here. So go ahead. We're getting close to the top of the hour anyhow. So, we'll put you on hold, Dr. Stan. And, let's do that. And then we'll come back next hour. Now, there's a number of things we do at the top of the hour, including a brand new K's commentary all about the UN. So stay with us here, and we will be doing that. And let's see, Dr. Charles, you're still there?
Yep, I'm still here.
Dr. Stan is on hold.
Sure.
And Christine, you're still there?
Yes, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about the test.
Okay.
Dr. Stan mentioned that I was not looking at all the tests. I have the literature from all of them in front of me, and I'd like to read a few select quotes on how they actually state they can't do what he believes and what a lot of people believe they can.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. So there's a whole lot of fun here ahead, and with special guests Christine Maggiore and Professor Charles Geschechter. We've got another guest, Dr. Stan Monteith, right here on your favorite radio station, AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey. We will be back in 6 minutes. It's 11 a.m.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Carton. Violent explosion. U.S. troops coming under fire at a vehicle checkpoint.
The quick reaction force reported finding one soldier killed in action, and two soldiers' duty status and whereabouts unknown.
For the missing soldiers is intense.
The military is trying to drum up some connections with local tribal leaders, some of them that are friendly to the coalition, and see if they know of any word of what may have happened to these two soldiers.
Fox's staff in Baghdad. The U.S. State Department says don't try it. Japan urged North Korea to halt a possible missile test tomorrow, saying it would be a provocative and dangerous action. The long-range missiles reach as far as the United States. On the record, Congress passing a symbolic resolution to support the war in Iraq, rejecting a timeline for troops to come home.
The A's are 256, the nays are 153.
And this issue, a very tricky one politically.
All but three Republicans voted for, all but 42 Democrats against. Democrats say the resolution trapped them into either supporting administration policies or risk looking like they're terror.
Radio's Mike Makowicz on Capitol Hill. And a report from the Department of Homeland Security giving failing grains in storm readiness to several U.S. cities.
In general, the report says not enough is being done. Study finding that Florida is the only state right now to meet all the requirements for disaster planning.
Fox's Kelly Rye. Disaster response plans in New Orleans, New York, and Washington all coming up short. Florida, the only state with just passing grades. President Bush says he told Iraq's leaders this week the United States will stand with them until Iraq is able to govern itself, sustain itself, and defend itself. In his weekly radio address, Bush says it's important for the Iraqi people to know that America will not abandon them. You're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
And we're back. Bob from Scranton, you're on the air.
Hi, Ted. Love the show. Long-time listener. First-time caller.
Thanks, Bob. Is there a special someone out there you'd like to talk about?
There is, Ted. I recently lost a very big part of my... Since college. For my belly, my paunch, my spare tire. I know we had some good times. God knows I'll never forget that night in Albuquerque with the burritos.
It's never easy to lose something that's been... Huge part of you, Bob. Where'd the magic go?
Well, I'd recently begun taking the stairs more and more instead of the elevator, and then we started seeing less and less of each other. One day, it was just gone.
Small step number 67. Take the stairs instead of the elevator or escalator. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to help become a healthier, well, you. Get started at www.smallstep.gov and take... to get healthy.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Iran's foreign minister says his country will probably suggest some amendments to a Western proposal aimed at persuading the Islamic nation to stop enriching uranium. No timeline yet set for the response. And Iran out of World Cup contention and sparking protests. More than 700 turned out in Frankfurt to protest Iran's president for denying... Holocaust. The president had vowed to visit the team if it advanced. It did not. Former Enron chief Jeffrey Skilling says he contemplated suicide after the company crumbled and he came under legal scrutiny. He tells the Wall Street Journal he decided life is better than the alternative. Skilling convicted in May of lying to investors and employees about Enron's health. The number one ranked golfer in the world did make the cut. Tiger Woods is out of the U.S. Open. In his first attempt at competitive golf since his father died last month, Woods shot two straight 76s, ending his streak of 39 straight majors. And a big NBA star making a big business play in another big comeback.
Michael Jordan, now part owner of the Charlotte Bobcats, joining businessman Robert Johnson in other financial as well. The deal gives Jordan final say in all basketball matters. Jordan played his college ball in North Carolina before his Hall of Fame pro career with the Bulls and Wizards. Chris Foster, Fox News Radio.
Life is imitating art. Paul, the cute beetle, turning 64. News Radio. Metzler. More.
When I get old and losing my head, many years from now.
He wrote the song at 16, recorded it at 24. 1967 album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Band. It became a hit. Before about to become for former Beatle Paul McCartney, Sunday his 64th birthday.
When I'm 64.
Not to worry. They say 64 is the new 44. And I'm Lisa Carton, Fox News Radio.
And you're listening to KSCO AM today. It's 5 minutes past 11 o'clock. I'm Jay Cruz. The look at your weather for today. Partly cloudy with fog. West winds at 8 miles per hour with highs around 75. Tonight, mostly cloudy with areas of fog. West winds around 6 miles per hour with lows around 55. Sunday, partly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning with west wind at 8 miles per hour. Highs around 71. Sunday night, partly cloudy. Fog with west wind around 9 miles per hour with lows around 56. Monday, partly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning. West wind at 9 miles per hour with highs around 69. As your Monterey Bay Boaters forecast for today, calls for northwest winds at 10 to 20 knots with strongest in the afternoon. Wind waves at 2 to 4 feet with a northwest swell 3 to 7 feet every 9 seconds with patchy fog. Stay tuned to KSCO AM 1080 for hour number 2 of the Saturday special with MZ.
And it's going to get hot this hour. Hour, I think.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you, but I'm sorry, baby, but I have to go. It's time for that wonderful record show. I'd love to visit, but you'll have to call back.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Controversy is the name of the game on the Saturday special, at least traditionally, and it's shaping up to be a controversial one for the next hour. Stay with us.
I'm sorry, baby, but I really gotta go to KSCO Radio. Bye.
Yeah, but before we continue our discussion of AIDS, now is the perfect time to play Kay's Whirling's latest commentary. So let's do that, okay?
The following is the KSCO commentary. Here is Kay's Whirling.
This is about the elephant in the room, which is a stylish synonym for the existence of a very obvious, unpleasant issue, which sooner or later must be dealt with. This time, the elephant is the relationship between our nation and the United Nations, the latter of which was created over 60 years ago in San Francisco, right after World War II. Many nations joined together in high hopes to prevent any future wars. That did not happen. One must wonder now, since the world learned some time ago that Kofi Annan, elected head of the UN, was in bed with the Iraqi scoundrel Saddam Hussein. Kofi personally received millions of dollars earmarked for the Food for Oil program, and also, inappropriately, he secured a very cushy job for his own son, among other shady deals. He's not fit to be leader of the World Organization. He's a bad role model. Yet he's still there running the UN. His credibility is gone. So why is he allowed to keep his lucrative and important job? It's a known fact that when a fish stinks, it stinks from the head down. And Kofi Annan refuses to resign, and he is the head that stinks. Our country is appearing embarrassingly impotent. We are the main contributor, giving billions of our dollars to support the UN, whose members have been our guests for a long time. More often than not, most U.S. proposals are routinely vetoed because many member nations of the UN vigorously dislike us. But they love our free hospitality, and they live in New York City like royalty, with many privileges the rest of us Americans do not have. One example, they are immune from receiving tickets for traffic violations, and that's insane. We're hated, not only because of the Iraqi war, but because we allow ourselves to be used by the UN, which has long ago worn out its welcome here. Let's have the strength of character to say, it's time to leave and find another place to live. Maybe France, Russia, Germany.
Michael, please sit back from the...
Oh, no. Oh, that's terrible. Look what I did here. I cut... I have to apologize to everybody. This is awful. It was almost the end of the commentary, and I clicked to listen to something from the comment line, not realizing that it's the same computer that's playing the commentary. I feel like such an idiot. Anyhow, we'll have to finish that up a little later on, I guess. My apologies to Mom and to everybody who was just really getting into that commentary, but... Okay, live radio. So we're back with Dr. Charles Geschechter and Christine Maggiore. We're talking about AIDS. And we also have Dr. Stan Monteith on hold. It's hard for us to put all three of them together, so we're going to play musical phones here. I think Christine was – both Christine and Charles both were – I don't know, a little irritated with what they heard from Dr. Stan. So what is it that bugged you guys?
Well, I wanted to talk about – I'm not as irritated as I am disappointed in the portrayal of this, you know, idea that our discussion is anti-logical and confusing when, as a matter of fact, we are putting forth facts. There's no conjecture. There's no stories. We're not talking estimates or rates. It's just simple facts. And one of the things that I found disappointing was Dr. Stan's suggestion that I'm simply looking at the wrong test kit literature when I say that there are no tests actually approved by the Food and Drug Administration for actually diagnosing HIV infection. I have them all in front of me. One is a confirmatory test that he apparently believes remedies the situation with the non-specificity of other tests is the viral load test. The literature says right here, the viral load test is not intended to be used as a screening test for HIV or as a diagnostic test to confirm the presence of HIV infection. So it's saying it cannot do what Dr. Stan believes and what many people believe and what it's used for every day, which is anti-logical and a big problem. Another problem that I want to mention briefly with regard to HIV tests is there's no standard interpretation within the United States, within government agencies, between government agencies and health agencies, or even from lab to lab as to what constitutes a positive test result. Just to give one brief example, the Department of Defense uses the highest standard for saying someone tests HIV positive. The blood banks, American Red Cross and blood banks use the lowest standard. Their mission, their aim, is to protect the blood supply. The Department of Defense wants as many new recruits as possible. So they tailor their interpretation of the test to suit their agenda. When you go in and take an HIV test and you give information about yourself, that is used in interpreting the results, and all the results are interpreted differently depending on where you're testing and who you say you are, and none of the tests can actually diagnose the presence of HIV itself or any specific lab markers.
Well, gee, so much for that. Let's. How about Charlie? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Dr. Stan is there also, but he's on hold.
Share with Christine a kind of dismay and disappointment what I heard. For the listeners who are interested, I mean, there's plenty of places you can go and do some reading on your own. I want to highly recommend a very powerful article that appeared in the mass circulation monthly magazine Harper's in March of this year. It was called Out of Control, AIDS and the Corruption of Medical Science. I'm told that that issue of Harper's sold more issues than any other issue in Harper's history. Readers can then go look at the May 2006 issue of Harper's, and they will see a good cross-section of letters, both pro and con, this article by Celia Farber, a journalist in New York, which, you know, kind of segues right into the kind of discussions we're having here. My point, I guess, back to Dr. Stan, is that there is abundant evidence, clear evidence, on the part of Dr. Jonathan Fishbein, for example, about the corruption of trials that were held in Uganda involving certain highly toxic drugs that were said to be, you know, containing or controlling or remedying or eliminating HIV. Like I said before, I'm interested in AIDS cases, and he knows that perhaps a crucial distinction is between what are known as surrogate markers, which the doctor can explain to your listeners, or I can, versus what we call clinical endpoints. A doctor always asks a patient, how are you feeling? And then after the prescription of some medication, says, how are you doing? And are those medications actually attending to the clinical symptoms? What's being done about a high fever or a cough or a diarrhea or a weight loss? That's what interests me as an economic historian concerned about the health and well-being of people in Africa. My final point here, Michael, is this. What you've had from Dr. Stan is a wonderful example of what I call the cultural romance with biological or chemical solutions to social problems. He would like to medicalize poverty, sexualize his African life. He infantilizes Africans in general with these wild stories about conspiracies over population control, which are absolutely belied by the kind of statistics I tried to give him for all of Africa. But if you'd like to look closely as I can at South Africa or Ethiopia or Somalia or Kenya, I'm happy to go there with him, or San Francisco. It doesn't matter. I'm interested in local statistics as best as I can marshal them.
Okay, let's bring Dr. Stan back on.
Well, I told you I would get the statistics. The latest statistics from the CDC were published in 2005. I will be getting the 2005 statistics soon. But this talks about the number of people living with AIDS in the United States for the year 2004. Whites, there were 145,935. Blacks, 178,233. Why are there so many more blacks with AIDS, living with AIDS in America?
There aren't so many more. I thought you were going to say a million blacks or something. Well, That's not so many more,
Michael,
Dr.
Stan. Michael, will you please let me go on? Those are the number living in the United States with AIDS. When blacks make up about 10 to 12% of our population, and the majority of the cases of AIDS, we should ask why. Now, let's go to the statistics. The number of cases that were actually diagnosed in the year 2004. These are the number of new cases that were diagnosed in the United States. There were 12,000 whites and 20,965 blacks. So the disease is predominantly in blacks in the United States, and the reason is because there's a disparity in the genetic structure, and there's two genes that the blacks have that we don't have that makes them much more susceptible to this disease, which is why it is so much more prevalent in Africa than it is in the United States. And I'm not questioning, first of all, that, you know, there is a lot of planned confusion as far as the diagnosis is concerned. They differentiate HIV and AIDS. It's all part of one disease, only with the HIV, why, of course, you don't necessarily begin to get the drop of your CD4 count. Now, as far as the diagnosis is concerned, and I'm sure, was it Christine who was a... our young lady there?
Yeah, she's on hold.
I'm surprised she didn't mention the Western blot test, because you make the diagnosis of HIV by, first of all, doing a LISA test, and if it's positive, you repeat it again, because it can be give you a false positive. Then you use a Western blot test. If you have the two of them confirmatory, there are other tests you can do. You can actually do... you can actually test and identify the virus, and they've done this in the military, but you know, it's not ordinarily done, because the other two tests, you know, if a couple of ELISAs are positive and the Western blot is positive, why, you're probably 99.5% sure. They can raise questions, you know, my goodness, you know, there are, sometimes you get a false positive. I can tell you that as a physician, sometimes they get a false positive biopsy on cancer, but are we to stop doing all biopsies for that reason? And what, of course, is being suggested is we stop doing testing for HIV. And then, of course, we carry over. There is no epidemic in Africa. Yes, there is an epidemic in Africa. Yes, a lot of people are dying of many other things. They're dying of malaria, totally unnecessarily. We outlawed DDT back in 1973, and approximately 100 million Africans have died since then, about 3,000 a year. And, of course, right now there's a disinformation program to tell you that only 1 million people die a year of malaria. The figure is 3 million. You can verify that on the Internet by going to Google and typing in malaria, and then 3 million people die a year. So there's a disinformation program in the United States about malaria, just as there's a disinformation program and a planned program to confuse us about what HIV is really all about, where it came from, and why we have not, until recently, begun doing what is necessary to stop this epidemic. Let me make one more point, and then I'll be quiet for a while. And that is that in 1986, representing the physicians of the county, Santa Cruz County, as I was the senior delegate at the California Medical Association, we put forward a program for routine testing of everybody who came into the doctor's offices, a routine premarital testing, routine prenatal testing, doing what was really intelligent to try to stop the epidemic. It has simply been within the last 3 months that the CDC has finally come out and said, gee, maybe we ought to start doing routine testing for HIV disease to try to stop the epidemic. 26 years into the epidemic, they're going to start doing what's right here in the United States. And I would simply ask, why have we waited all this time?
What do you think the reason is?
I believe that there's an organized effort not to address the epidemic. 500,000 people have died.
Okay.
Unnecessarily, I wrote a book entitled AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic. And I believe it's as true today as when I wrote it.
Right. Okay, thanks, Dr. Stan. We're going to put you on hold here and see what the others have to say here. Let's see. Charles, you're there, but hold on a second. Let me bring on Christine also, because she was spoken of. Okay, Christine, what do you got to say here?
Well, I'm concerned with the evangelical tone of Dr. Stan's remarks. It would be better if we stuck to just the facts of the matter, and the fact of the matter keeps returning to the point that Western blot, ELISA, viral load tests make no claims whatsoever that they are able to diagnose actual infection with HIV. I don't want to keep bringing that up to belabor that point, but it just seems to get missed in this discussion of his about purposeful confusion campaigns. And I'm also very concerned about the notion he puts forth of the genetic inferiority of blacks in their ability to fight disease. We know that people who are malnourished and underserved tend to get sick more often than those with access to medical care, food, and water.
Regardless of race.